Good evening, everyone. We're talking about spiritual warfare. We were going to start with Job tonight, and we've got limited time. I've got way more material than we have time. So let's just cut right to it. When Satan and Job, or pardon me, when Satan and God are talking there in Job 1, Satan is, of course, the accuser, and he begins by accusing Job. And what does he accuse Job of? What does he say to God? God says, "Have you considered my servant Job? There's none like him." And what's Satan say? You don't have to have the exact words, but in essence, what does he say? Right. That's an accusation. He is only serving you because you're making life good for him. And how does Satan describe that? You've put a hedge around him. Now, we know what a hedge would look like in the physical world. You know, it's going to be made of some kind of shrubbery, or maybe you build it with some stones and rock. What did this hedge look like? All right, blessings, although a hedge has to do with protection, and I don't disagree with that necessarily. I don't, as far as results go. But Satan sensed that there was protection around Job, keeping the things that Satan wanted to happen to him from happening. In the context of spiritual warfare, what might, at least, that hedge have involved? All right. I think there's very biblical reason for believing that that hedge may well have involved angels. In fact, that may have been ultimately what the hedge was. Notice Satan's language, chapter 1, verse 10 of Job, "You have made a hedge around him." In 2 Kings chapter 6, Elisha is in the city of Dothan. The king of Syria has brought his army surrounding the city. He's hoping to capture, if not kill, Elisha. And Elisha is not concerned about this at all. His servant is, and Elisha prays to God, "Lord, open his eyes." And what does his servant see? The mountain is full of what? All right, horses and chariots of fire. But notice how it words it. 2 Kings 6:17, "The mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha." Now, God had pulled the curtain back, but here were these angelic beings, and they were around Elisha, protecting him from the armies of Syria. When Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were in the fiery furnace, Nebuchadnezzar looks in there, and our King James and New King James has some saying, "There's one in there who looks like the Son of God." However, just about every other translation you check, if not every other translation you check, it's not going to say "like the Son of God." It's going to say "like a son of the gods," which makes a lot more sense coming out of the mouth of a pagan. Because I don't think Nebuchadnezzar is making commentary about the coming Messiah, but he looks in there and he sees a being who's clearly not human. There is a being in there who is from another world and may well, and likely was, an angel. Psalm 34, verse 7, "The angel of the Lord encamps all around those who fear him and delivers them." Psalm 91, which Satan quoted to Saint Jesus, but it's not messianic. Read Psalm 91. I was surprised. I don't know, 2, 3, 4 years ago, I was reading Psalm 91. I thought, this is not messianic. This is about any believer. Psalm 91, verses 11 and 12. "God shall give his angels charge over you to keep you in all your ways. In their hands they shall bear you up, lest you dash your foot against a stone." And of course, it was an angel who protected Daniel when he was in the lion's den. Now, what's the Bible telling us? Angels are protectors. They protected people under the old covenant, and I think there's good reason to believe they are still protecting God's people in the new covenant, which raises, of course, the question, is there such a thing as a guardian angel? What do you think? Do you have a guardian angel tonight? The passage often cited for this is Matthew chapter 18. You're free to turn there if you would like. Matthew chapter 18, verse 10, Jesus made this statement. Matthew chapter 18, verse 10. "Take heed that you do not despise one of these little ones. Take heed that you do not despise one of these little ones, for I say to you that in heaven their angels always see the face of my Father who is in heaven." Now, the question number one is, who are these little ones? Well, the most common interpretation is they're children. My child has a guardian angel, many Bible-believing people would say. And I'm not going to say that's wrong, but what did Jesus say back in verse 6? In verse 6, he spoke of these little ones who what? If you happen to be there, Matthew 18, verse 6. What's that? Yes, one of those little ones who believe in me. So when Jesus says 4 verses later that these little ones have their angels see the Father, He's not talking about children, at least not exclusively. He's including those who have become as little children. So now the question is, does Jesus mean that each individual Christian has an individual, a particular angel who's been assigned to him or her? Or is he saying that believers as a group have angels as a group, their angels, who are before the Father, have his favor, have his honor, and this is, of course, the point is, don't ever despise even the weakest of brethren, because God is showing them honor. There are angels who are seeing the face of God right now who have some involvement with them. God has honored them, so you need to also. But do you have an individual angel, or is it a group, the heavenly group, caring for the earthly group? I'm going to suggest to you that in light of a couple of pieces of evidence, the more likely of the two is the more common version. This idea of a guardian angel was a well-established doctrine among the Jews prior to the New Covenant. And that didn't make it right, but they'd probably gotten the idea from some of those passages in the Old Testament we just hurriedly went through. This is what they believed. And so when Jesus made this statement, what would his Jewish hearers have thought? Well, they most likely would have interpreted him to be affirming what they already believed. That's how they would have understood it. And Jesus does nothing to indicate to them that their understanding was incorrect. And furthermore, years later, in Acts chapter 12, we have Christians who are aware of what Jesus said. And Peter comes to John Mark's mother's house in the middle of the night when they're expecting him to die the next day. They're likely praying about him because he's supposed to be executed the next day. Peter shows up. They just can't believe it's Peter. And what do they conclude? Acts chapter 12, verse 15. What do they say about Peter? It's his angel. Now, what do they mean by that? Well, it was a belief among the Jews that your guardian angel could take your form. Now, the Bible's not signing off on that. But here are people post-Jesus, post-New Covenant, and they still believe that believers have their own individual angels. So, is that a home run? No. But that is evidence to suggest that just as, and Lord willing, we're going to talk about this before the night is over, just as God has, at least in the past and probably still in the present, has permitted an angel to be associated with particular earthly kingdoms, so also that there are angels specifically associated with particular believers. Comments, questions? When God mentions Job to Satan, Satan knows who he is. Satan knows who Job is, and he even has opinions about him. He knows particulars about his life, and he has opinions about him, or at least claims to have opinions. How honest and genuine these accusations are is a question. So why is that relevant to you? Because if you're a Christian tonight, Satan almost certainly knows about you. As an individual, you are not a mystery to him. He is the accuser of our brethren. He has to know who the brethren are. He knows who you are. He likely knows particulars about you, allowing him to, at least in his eyes, have something to say about you. Satan is not willy-nilly about his accusations. He was able to make specific accusations against Job in Zechariah 3, which we're not going to have time to cover. He makes specific accusations against Joshua the high priest in the days of Zerubbabel. If Satan attempted to make accusations about you, what would he say? And would there be any truth to it? The accuser accuses Job, and then the tempter tempts Job. How does he tempt him? He strips him of his oxen and donkeys through a Sabian raid. A nation of people, a group of people come and they raid Job's property. A Chaldean raid strips him of his camels and servants. Fire, possibly lightning, consumes his sheep and other servants. And how would lightning do that? That would be a thing to see. But something, fire comes down and consumes his sheep and other servants. And then this great wind, is this a microburst? Is this a tornado? I don't know. But this wind comes and it causes the four corners of the house to collapse. And then, of course, he deals with painful boils from head to toe. What does this teach us? That God had a hedge of protection, likely involving angels at least, one or more, protecting Job. But when God chose for his good purposes to do otherwise, he instructed an angel or angels, you're going to permit more than you have before. And Satan had the power. He had the power to create or manipulate weather phenomena. He had the power to inaugurate or orchestrate peoples engaging in military actions. He had the ability to cause disease. Does he still have those abilities? We can be sure that he does if God allows it. God allowed it on Paul. What did Paul say he dealt with? What did he call his thorn in the flesh? It was a messenger of Satan. And take a guess what the word for messenger is in the Greek. It's the word for angel. Just like God had permitted physical illness in Job's life as a trial to increase his faith, but Satan was using it as a temptation to destroy his faith, so also God allowed Satan, presumably through one of his angels, to bring physical disease on Paul. Of course, God allowed it to keep Paul humble. Satan, no doubt, had other designs. Satan brought on Job wind and fire. I think that's interesting. What is Ephesians 2:2 called Satan? He is the prince of the power of the air. So he brings wind from the atmosphere. He brings fire down from the atmosphere. And what are we told in Hebrews 1 verse 7? That God makes his angels spirits, says our King James, but the Greek, he makes them winds. I mean, the Greek bears that out. Other translations render it that way, and it fits better, I think. God makes his angels winds and his ministers a flame of fire. We see when Elijah's taken up into heaven, well, that's the work of angels. He goes up in a whirlwind, and there was a chariot and a horse of fire. May well be that Satan's angels, assuming the form of wind and fire, were the ones executing this on Job. What's this have to do with you and me? I was at the doctor 5 years ago, four or five, I'm starting to lose track. I was having multiple health issues at the time. That was a new thing for me. It had me down. It had me scared. My doctor had been a missionary over in China, so he was a man of faith. There's some things I don't think he understands, but he has a man of some faith. And I told him, so we're able to talk about these things to a point. I told him, I'm like, you know, I'm praying to God, Lord, whatever it is you want me to learn, please help me to learn it. And then he goes, and there's also the issue of spiritual warfare. And I didn't really process what he was saying. But there's biblical grounds for what he is saying. Might God allow Satan, one of his demons, to bring sickness, disease, into your life for his purposes? Absolutely he may, based on the testimony we have. I'm not saying he does, but I have no reason to believe he wouldn't. And Murray wrote a number of years ago, and I'm losing track of time, 8, 9, 10 years ago, we were having a lot of health issues, a lot of very serious health issues. And it got to the point where a prayer meeting was called. And as the prayers are going around, and I can't remember if it was before or after, but one of the brothers made the remark, could it be that God is permitting this to wake us up to something? And I appreciated the fact he brought that. Does that mean that's what God was doing? I don't know. There's such a thing as time and chance, but is it possible that God would do a thing? We have to be open to that. Job needed to learn something, and maybe some of us do too. At some point, Satan or one of his demons or his demons invented idolatry. There's no record of idolatry prior to the flood. It doesn't mean it wasn't there. But I can think of reasons why idolatry might not have worked prior to the flood. It was only 1,500 years from creation to the flood. People are living 1,000 years. You very possibly have people alive whose grandpa or great-grandpa saw the cherubim, saw the fiery sword, and may have, he was still there. I mean, the Bible doesn't tell us when that got removed. So there may have been a number of things that would keep idolatry from being workable prior to the flood, but it definitely got started if not before the flood, soon after. Abraham lived about 2000 BC, 500 years after the flood, and his father, Terah, had been an idolater. We're told that in Joshua chapter 24. And I bring up idolatry because the Bible says something to us about idolatry that it doesn't say about a whole lot of other things. In fact, I don't know that it says it about anything else. Deuteronomy chapter 32, verses 16 through 17, speaking, Moses talking about what Israel was going to do in the future. Deuteronomy 32, beginning in verse 16, they provoked him to jealousy with foreign gods. Verse 17, they sacrificed to demons, not to God, to gods they did not know, to new gods, new arrivals that your fathers did not fear. Psalm 106, beginning in verse 30 through 37, they even sacrificed their sons and their daughters to demons, the blood of their sons and daughters whom they sacrificed to the idols in Canaan. So in the Old Testament, when people were worshiping idols, when they were sacrificing their children to idols, the Bible's telling us they were, whether they realized it or not, sacrificing and worshiping demons. And did that stop with the Old Covenant? It did not. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 1:10 that those who worship idols or sacrifice to idols, they sacrifice to demons. So it was going on in the New Covenant. So what about today? Well, if idolatry had you worshiping a demon then, we can be sure it, the same is true now. But that just happens on the other side of the world, right? I mean, I know I'm not alone in this. I go into a restaurant, and we're not just talking about the funny Chinese Santa Claus. I mean, we're talking about real idols now. You can see them at a restaurant. You can see them at a hotel. I walked into a gas station in Raytown just several years ago, and here it was up in an elevated place. And I looked at the gentleman on the other side of the counter, and I said, is that an idol? He goes, yes, that is my God. So this is real, and it's here. And it's not just in paganism. It's not just in non-Christian, non-Muslim, non-Jewish faith. Revelation 9, I'm not going to recapitulate that because you've already studied it. But in Revelation 9, at the end of the sixth seal, in verse 20, the sixth seal is depicting the Turks taking the city of Constantinople in 1453. And Constantinople was the capital city of the Eastern Roman Empire, what we call the Byzantine Empire. It was a Catholic empire. A Catholic empire. And it fell. This showed that it did not have God's favor. It fell to a Muslim power. If you were of that faith, what should Constantinople's fall have told you? God does not favor this faith. There's something wrong. But Revelation 9, verse 20 says, but the rest of mankind who were not killed by these plagues did not repent of the works of their hands. That's code for idolatry. That they should not worship demons. And idols of gold, silver, brass, stone, and wood, which can neither see nor hear nor walk. I don't want to be, but I want to speak truth. 1 Timothy 4 teaches us that Catholicism is a doctrine of demons. Revelation makes it very clear that the beast rises up out of the bottomless pit. He rises up out of the realm of the demons. And to worship and to venerate, as it's called, to pray to Mary, to pray to St. Michael. I was just talking to somebody Monday evening. I was in a Bible study with three women, all three of whom have real history with the Catholic faith. And one of them has a lot of family that's still involved in it, and you know, she's a relatively new Christian. She's kind of wrestling with how to juggle all these things, and she made the decision, not one I would have made, but she made the decision to go ahead and go to her, I don't know, his niece or grandniece or however these, I don't know exactly what the relation was, but she was going to be getting baptized. Quote, unquote, for the tape recording. She's sitting there, and the priest starts praying to Michael, calling upon Michael the archangel. She was very taken. She was very surprised by this. There were things the people were bowing to, and she was not going to bow to it. She was very troubled by this proceeding, as she should have been. A number of you have real-life experience with this. And by God's grace, you've seen the truth, and we want others to see the truth too. But we know people, some of them family, some of them friends, we know people who, though they do not realize it, are laying their living sacrifice before a demon. They are praying to things other than God. They are worshiping these individuals, and they are worshiping demons. Hand in hand with idolatry is the occult. You know, you look in Revelation chapter 21, verse 8, I believe it is, and where it lists the people who are going to go to the lake of fire, and idolatry, idolaters and sorcerers go right together. We could go a long list, I'm not going to do that, but where we see idolatry in the Old Testament, we very frequently see the occult. They often go together. So that raises the question, if to worship an idol is to worship a demon, and these idolatrous religions are doctrines of demons, then does that mean that the occult, which goes hand in hand with this and grows out of it, does that mean that demons are able to exercise supernatural power through these things? How many of us have wondered that? And I do not like the answer I'm about ready to give you, but I don't know. I knew a man in college, a man who in the time I knew him was very devout. He attended a Church of Christ that believes you have to use one cup in the Lord's Supper. But when he had been younger, he had been wild, rebellious, and he had prayed to Satan. And he claimed that one indication, actually it may have been his brother, had been engaged in this sort of thing. And yeah, in both cases, they started getting answers. They started getting responses. I don't know. I don't know what to do with that. The stories about Ouija boards, I don't know. If you open up your mind looking for those influences, is it possible that that opens the door for them to be exercised somewhat? It's possible. It shouldn't be toyed with, I know that. Boy, how are we doing on time? We're going to need to skip ahead here. Saul. The demons love to bring pain. And God permitted an evil spirit, the King James says, a distressing spirit, says the New King James. He allowed one of Satan's servants to trouble Saul. That spirit, though, was only came after what? How would you characterize Saul at the point that that evil spirit came? What sorts of things had gone down in his life by that time? And why? Yeah. And David did things he shouldn't have done, but when Nathan the prophet came to David and said, "You're the man," what did David say? "I've sinned against the Lord." When Samuel shows up in 1 Samuel 15, and Saul was supposed to have killed all the Amalekites, including the king, and killed all the animals, and he saved a whole bunch of the animals, and he spared Agag, and Saul, and Samuel, even before Samuel gets anything out of his mouth, what is Saul saying? "Blessed are you of the Lord, I have obeyed the commandment of the Lord." Liar. And he knew he was lying. He's trying to pull the wool. He's trying to rationalize. He's trying to get ahead of the game, not be called out. Of course, Samuel has that great answer. "Well, then is the bleating of the sheep in my ears?" And Saul's got all kinds of rationalizations. "Oh, well, we, you know, the people, they're the ones who saved the animals, and we're going to worship, we're going to sacrifice them to God." And Samuel says, "Be quiet and listen to what the Lord has to say." And only after repeated admonitions and being called out as a liar does Saul finally say, "I've sinned." But he didn't really care. Persistent, willful, habitual, unrepented of sin, sin that he was willing to lie about to get away with, this was his condition when that spirit was sent. It came after only after the Spirit of God had left him, which was a result of his direct result of his rebellion. And even after it came, and this is the reason I want to linger on Saul for just a moment, even after that evil spirit came and was creating emotional, mental struggles for Saul, greater than he had brought on himself, what would make the spirit go away? David plays some music. Music soothes the savage breast. He would calm down. He would get a feel better, and state of mind would change and the spirit would leave. What does this teach us? 2 Kings chapter 3, three kings come to Elisha. Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, Joram, the son of Ahab. He wasn't as bad as Ahab, but he was still bad. And the king of Edom. And they're wanting to go battle against Moab, but they're concerned that God's not going to let this work out. And so they come to Elisha looking for a prophecy, and Elisha says, if it weren't for the fact that I regard the presence of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, I wouldn't even look at you. Elisha's not a happy man with these men. But Jehoshaphat is there, so Elisha is willing to give them a word from the Lord, but before he gives them a word from the Lord, what does he do? 2 Kings 3:15, he says, call in a musician. The musician begins to play. This changes Elisha's state of mind, apparently, and then the hand of the Lord comes upon him. You have to have a certain state of mind if you want the Spirit to work in you. And a certain state of mind will drive the evil spirit away. That spirit could find a home in Saul's life and heart because Saul let it. Again, does God do that sort of thing today? Is it possible that if a person persists in willful, habitual sin, rationalizing it, being willing to let God soften their heart and harden their heart, is it possible that God will send them an evil spirit and make a bad situation worse? I have to think that's a possibility. You know, cognitive dissonance, we don't do well with that. You can't live with it forever. Somehow it's got to resolve itself. Satan delights to fish in troubled waters. So we've got to decide what kind of water we're going to be. Am I going to be troubled water, or am I going to turn to the Lord and let him give me peace like a river? It was there because Saul let it. God never takes away our free will. We're going to need to move on to the last point I wanted to look at, and that is things going on in the days of Daniel. Acts chapter 17, verse 26. In Daniel, of course, there in chapter 10, it's a famous chapter, we see angels engaged in warfare. And that warfare involves nations. So in Acts chapter 17, verse 26, Paul makes an interesting statement to the Athenians. He's talking to Gentile peoples, and he says to them, Acts 17, 26, speaking of God, he says, he has made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on all the face of the earth. And here's why I've taken us to this verse. And he has determined their pre-appointed times and the boundaries of their dwellings. Now, this is a very familiar verse, but let's reread that. Speaking of all the nations of men, these different countries and peoples, God has made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on all the face of the earth. We're all human beings. We're all of equal value before God. But concerning the nations, God has determined their pre-appointed times. So 1776 was preordained by God. Fascinating. And if the world continues and America falls before the world does, that fall will be because that's when God determined the nation to fall. Now, one thing that's very important to remember is that God deals with individuals differently than he deals with nations. Admittedly, the doctrine of predestination is a little difficult for me to hammer out entirely, but I know we have free will. And what God does with a nation does not have any bearing on the eternal salvation or damnation of an individual. That's entirely within your power with God's help. But God has predetermined every nation that has risen and fallen. It did that on God's timetable. And furthermore, he says there, Paul says, he has determined their pre-appointed times and what? The boundaries of their dwellings. So sea to shining sea is God's determined boundaries for the United States. Ukraine has the boundaries it does, and it may be that God grants, has plans for those to change from time to time. Russia has the boundaries it does. China has the boundaries it does. Iran has the boundaries it does because God has determined those. He predetermined the rise and fall, when it would happen, and he's determined what their boundaries will be. Now, what's that have to do with Daniel? Well, when did God divide the nation? When did the world become a place where there were multiple nations? Right, it was a Babel, of course. In the days of Peleg, says Genesis chapter 10, verse 25, and it seems like that may have reference to that time. Peleg was born 101 years after the flood, and he was named Peleg, I presume, by his father. To Eber were born two sons. The name of one was Peleg, for in his days the earth was divided. So if that's talking about what happened to Babel, that tells us when it happened. It took about 100 years for men to multiply on the face of the earth and get big enough that they're concerned about spreading out. So let's build this place. Let's all stay together. Let's make a name for ourselves. And that was a bad idea. So God shut that down. In Deuteronomy chapter 32, and I'm going to go ahead and turn to this passage, we're told something about that dividing of the nations. What happened at Babel, God, of course, always operates on a plan. He always operates according to order. Deuteronomy chapter 32, in this Song of Moses, we're going to start in verse 7. Deuteronomy 32, verses 7 and 8. Remember the days of old. So this is just before Moses dies. He's going to die in the next chapter. Remember the days of old. Consider the years of many generations. Ask your father and he will show you, your elders and they will tell you, when the Most High divided their inheritance to the nations. Now that's Hebrew for the Gentile nations. God had an inheritance for these Gentile nations when he made that division, which was at Babel or soon thereafter. When the Most High divided their inheritance to the nations, when he separated the sons of, not Abraham, but Adam. So we're talking about these nations, pre-Old Covenant. When he Most High divided their inheritance to the nations, when he separated the sons of Adam, he set the boundaries of the peoples, exactly like what Paul talked about in Acts 17, 26. He set the boundaries of the peoples according to the number of the children of Israel. Now, that's interesting. The overwhelming majority of translations and all but one Hebrew manuscript read that way, that he set the boundaries of the nations according to the number of the children of Israel. Now, if that's accurate, which there's a lot of evidence to suggest that it is, that would mean that when God was arranging, setting up the arrangement of the nations, it in some way was arranged and distributed according to how it related to Israel. Israel was God's people, and the other nations mattered. Where he was going to put them and when was relating back to how it was going to affect Israel, which is a fascinating thing to consider. And I'm fascinated by what's been going on over there my whole lifetime. It's interesting. Their boundaries keep getting bigger since they got their land back. And I don't know. I'm no prophet, but I just wonder. Acts 17, 26, where we just were, it said he determined the pre-appointed times and the boundaries of their dwellings so that they should seek the Lord. Could it be that God is giving the Jewish nation, they're not his chosen people anymore, the church is his chosen people, they can become part of the chosen people, but is it possible that God is giving the Jewish nation their land back, setting them up for what Paul talks about in Romans 11? That turning on their part prior to the end. I don't know. I wonder. But I need to get through this. I don't want to miss this. Do I need to stop 1 minute? Okay. So in the Dead Sea Scrolls, we have the oldest Hebrew manuscript of Deuteronomy 32:8. And it does not say according to the number of the children of Israel. The oldest Hebrew manuscript we have of Deuteronomy 32:8 says that God set the boundaries of the nations according to the number of the sons of God. You're like, But then you go to the Septuagint. The Septuagint was the Greek translation from the Hebrew, and our copies of the Septuagint, at least one of them, predate this oldest copy oldest Hebrew copy of Deuteronomy 32:8. And the Septuagint reads that he set the boundaries of the peoples according to the number of the angels of God. Go to Job. What are the sons of God? They're angels. So it looks like the Septuagint translators were maybe looking at sons of God and chose to render it angels of God. If that's the case, isn't that interesting? Because what do we see in Daniel chapter 10? We see a prince, this is an angel, of the kingdom of Greece. We see a prince of the kingdom of Persia. And they're battling with who? An angel of God. And there's a particular angel who's named. He's one of the chief princes. He's the great prince who watches over the nation of Israel. And that's Michael. I don't see any indication in Scripture that this has changed. It could have changed, but there's no statement in Scripture that it has changed. And based on what the Bible is revealing, it may well be that right now there is an angel of the United States. There's a prince of China. There's a prince of Russia. There's a prince. And think about this. If there is the prince of God's people is Michael. He's the one fighting for God's people in Revelation 12. So who's the prince of the United States if there is one? It's one of Satan's angels. So think about that. This is not God's country. This is a country God uses. But if there are battles going on, we're seeing in our own country now war being waged against things that would benefit God's people and the thing God's people stand for. So I hate to close hanging there, but we're going to do that. See you next week, Lord willing.